ants are stupid, though, and these beastly goblins are not. There is no honey that will lure them, Garkescu added. But there was. I thought about the cavern that was hidden somewhere under Beauvall Castle, and tried to think of a way to use it to our advantage. Perhaps if we had more time, we could bargain possession of it for our lives, or attempt something daring. But we didn't have that time, and approaching Sayakusi with the matter would be difficult in the best of times. The old coot wasn't about to give up his beautiful castle to anyone. Even if I had my way, using the cavern as a bargaining point called for a lot more finesse than I could manage after the hellish time of the last few days.
How about, counter-tunnel?
Rondol asked hesitantly. What do you mean? Dig a tunnel under theirs, and then come up from beneath them? An undermine? I considered for a moment. It wasn't a bad plan, but too time-consuming and manpower-intensive. Even with magical assistance, Gavanni were natural diggers. Even aided by magic, there was no way that a counter-tunnel could be dug through the rocky ground in time to do any good. I said as much, but congratulated the boy on his thinking, which earned a sneer from his master. Another three or four suggestions were bandied about, none of them practical for the situation at hand. We stared at the map and moved pieces representing our forces and the Gavanni from place to place, but the plans kept getting too elaborate to put into action, or failed for the lack of resources. We did have some useful insights while we worked, though. We took turns scrying the tunnel and the goblins within, updating our model as we did so. We discovered that it came in from under a nearby hill, where they could dig without much notice. We had noticed it earlier, actually, but to our inexperienced eyes it looked like a bunker against our missiles, or a quarry for the field fortifications they were constructing. The entrance had been disguised from our scrying by magic and activity. Its true purpose was kept hidden from our scrying by a group of privacy-minded shamans, I guessed. But what we did discover was important and impressive. The tunnel was roughly 280 yards long, 6 to 10 feet wide, with pockets every 40 feet or so where gear could be stored and goblins could rest. It was deepest, just under our wall, plunging down almost 100 feet below the surface before sloping back up at a steep angle. The Gavanni engineers had taken great pains, it seemed, to avoid hurting the castle's physical defences overmuch. The shamans, likewise, had cast spells to keep us from collapsing the tunnel by magic, especially under the moat, which would have conveniently flooded the tunnel. I wasn't sure why they were being so delicate with the mine. Perhaps they planned on making it their summer home next year. The problem was that even if we succeeded in fighting them back into the tunnel, they could easily outflank us by digging around us. Indeed, the tunnel branched out in a few other incomplete forks, prepared as a contingency or as miscalculation, I guessed. But many of them could be continued to penetrate the walls again. Stop one breach, only to be confronted by another in your rear. No, this serpent needed to be cut in half, and quickly, before it grew more heads. I just couldn't think of an easy way to do that without killing a lot more people than I wanted. I was getting frustrated as it was starting to get dark outside. People were going to start dying soon if we didn't hit upon anything workable. The heaps of rock and wood that were our next makeshift line of defense were manned and ready, but they wouldn't hold out long against a prolonged assault buoyed by attrition.
"If we bring the rocks of the wall down on them, they'll have to retreat," Tyndall offered, eagerly.
"And we'll have an even bigger hole for the next lot to worm through,"
Garkescu pointed out disdainfully.
"Perhaps we could just persuade them to go away," suggested Rondol nervously.
"Not with those shamans fighting us," Tyndall pointed out. "Just scrying that breach was hard enough."
We needed a plan. I looked at the map and scowled. There just wasn't a particularly elegant way to go about this. I came to a conclusion. Okay, we need to quit trying to finesse this thing, and just hit it in the head.
Won't that just force them to try another approach?
Garkescu asked sourly. Let's just focus on the magic, and forget about grand strategy for a while, I cautioned evenly. First, we need to protect our people behind the barricades. The shamans are working defensive and support magic at the moment,
but they'll soon move on to offensive magic, unless I miss my guess. Without us, there is nothing that will stop them, and our defenders will be down before they strike another blow. Tyndall, Garkescu, I'm putting you in charge of that. Divide the line in two, starting from the midpoint between these two towers, and start planning magical defenses.
What kind of defenses?
Tyndall asked, doubtfully. So far, the shamans have only thrown basic combat magic at us, but you should plan for fire and cold, and lightning, too. I am wagering that they will rely more on the raw power of the stones than subtler spells. Rondal, I want you to go on the offensive. Throw everything at them that you can against that redoubt, and vary it quickly, before they can adapt. Try not to hurt the wall, but if that's what it takes, then so be it. Cover any weaknesses in the center, between Tyndall and your master, but mostly stay on their furry black asses like an obsessed flea, and try not to get in the way of the infantry, will you? The longer they stay alive, the more effective a shield for your attack. If the tide seems to be turning your way, do not be fooled. Do not, under any circumstances, follow the Gavani back into their tunnels. Even an enhanced war mage would have a hard time fighting clear. Rondal nodded, squinting thoughtfully at the map.
And what about you, Master?
Tyndall asked, expectantly. I stared back at him and sighed. He expected some intricately plotted spell that I would pull out of my ass and save the day with, like I had with the unfastening spell. There was no reason why he shouldn't. So far, that's exactly what had happened. The fact that inspiration wasn't exactly lighting up my mind meant that perhaps today he would be disappointed. I hate to disappoint a doting apprentice. Tunnels have two ends. I'm going to sneak over the wall tonight and see if I can't stop the flow of enemies from the other end, I said confidently. Dear gods, don't ask me how, I prayed, as the other magi nodded in appreciation, because I don't have the faintest idea. Thankfully, they didn't. Instead, they all looked at me as if I had the perfect plan in mind, parts of which were just too complicated to reveal. I wasn't about to discourage the notion, especially not before a battle in which their confidence would play a crucial role. If they fought like demons because they thought I was out there valiantly slaying goblins by the horde, then I wasn't going to tell them otherwise. All right, then. We have our basic assignments. Let's talk tactics. For my part of the mission, I chose an escort of 10 fast black flag troopers, the best that Captain Ferrando could loan me. I had to admire the man. He was way out of his element, which was normally charging gallantly into battle on the field of combat. Instead, he was plotting the intricacies of a siege, with which he had little experience. Yet he had not once lost command of his wits or his morale. He was approaching the situation as a problem to be solved, not a certain fight to the last man, which I could appreciate. The 10 men he loaned me were veterans unafraid of the dangers of goblins at night. At least, that's what he told me. We would go on horse to try to cover the relatively unguarded stretch of land between the wall and the hill. Before I left, I checked in with my magic corps in their designated positions and made certain they knew what they were supposed to do. I gave Alia a kiss and a long embrace at the gatehouse before I departed, wondering if I'd ever see her again. Finally, I hung a dozen of my own spells, checked the war wands in my harness, loosed Slasher in its scabbard on my back, and sped off on Traveller, out the front gate, like a real gentleman, the black flag troopers following behind me. The sun was already setting, and I could hear the disturbing sound of Gavani war drums from their great encampments ringing the castle. They played those drums every night, for some reason. It's a spooky sound when you first hear it, but over the course of the last weeks, it had become a familiar part of the background noise, until everyone in the castle had grown used to it. We even started to criticize the various drummers' performances with the peculiar sort of gallows humor that the besieged quickly develop. Tonight was one of their better, more dramatic percussionists, I noted, quite fitting for one likely riding off to his death. I called the men into a gallop, maintaining a tight formation, and cast some simple wards around us that would discourage any Gavani from noticing us as out of the ordinary. We galloped to a point about halfway between the castle and the small hill that concealed their digging, encountering few pickets. The field was fairly clear of Gervani patrols, which I thought odd, but welcomed all the same. I had loaded up on additional and more complex concealment spells before we departed, but I was unsure of their effectiveness, and overuse of such spells can attract as much attention as carrying torches as we rode. Even with the remnants of spells and counterspells overhanging the land around the castle, like smoke from fires, providing some residual interference against casual scrying, I didn't want to take any chances. Stray magics can have a subtle impact on even the most potent and well-directed of spells. Calling attention to ourselves by casting spells to not call attention to ourselves is one of those subtle points good war magi learn early on. Poor war magi usually don't live long enough to develop that subtle sophistication. I led the troops quickly and directly to our business, portraying an outward confidence that I now wore like a favorite hat. Truthfully, I had only the barest hint of an idea for a plan. I barely understood what I was going to do, much less knew how I was to do it. I was kind of hoping something would occur to me before I got to the spot I had picked. It didn't. At least not immediately. We slowed to a trot, dismounted, and then walked the horses until I was over the spot I'd chosen. There was a weakness here that we'd theorized might be exploited. Perhaps not, but that's what I was here to figure out. I muttered in the Black Flag officer's ear as the first of the stars came out. "Keep on guard, petty captain, and keep your men quiet. See that I am undisturbed for a few moments, would you?" The man nodded, and then ordered the men into a casual defensive position around me while I prepared my spell. Scrying from a distance, we had noticed, actually Rondal had noticed, something interesting about one particular bend in the tunnel. It veered left, as I faced the castle, for about 35 feet, then back again for about 20. There was no obvious reason for it. Ideally, a mining shaft should travel in as straight a line as possible. A 50-foot spur broke off to the right, and then stopped. I had thought it a contingency tunnel, until Rondal pointed out that it was probably a simple jog around a rock too big to move. Apart from cows and lusty peasant girls, such rocks are one of the things Beauval grows in abundance. Upon further examination closer to the site, directly over it, actually, the small scrying glass I carried showed that the obstacle the Gervani had avoided was not merely a rock, but a seam of low-grade coal, not uncommon in this area, though rarely exploited. That gave me an idea. While I know coal is mined in the south, in the Wilderlands, where wood is so plentiful for fuel, mining coal for the purpose of heating and cooking was rare. It's used by smithies and occasionally by doctors and barbers, but the Wilderlands has plenty of trees to get through before the common folk relied upon it for heat. I paced it off as the spell showed me what I wanted to see in the glass. The seam carried on for about 90 feet, roughly parallel to the wall of the castle, then petered out to the northeast and southwest. The Gervani were smart sappers. Going around the seam was easier and safer than going through it. But their excavations around it had exposed a considerable portion of the seam inside the tunnel as they sought its end. And coal burns, if you can heat it up enough, I reminded myself. That was pretty much the gist of my plan. The tunnel itself was protected against casual scrying, but I was right over it, and powered through that spell. It had a few other enchantments here and there that I guessed were safety-related, such as anti-cave-in spells, spells against water pooling, that sort of thing. Mining magic isn't really a specialty of mine. I could tell that one kept fresh air flowing from the tunnel head, allowing the sappers to work without having to open ventilation shafts, which would have given their position away to our observers. The spells they were using were pretty powerful, too, from what I could understand of them. Too powerful to break them up lightly without them noticing almost immediately. But I wasn't going to try to dispel it. Indeed, I hoped to use it, and that seam of coal, to make things very uncomfortable in that tunnel before long. It took me a few moments to piece together what needed to be done before I did it, but it was a basic alchemy thaumaturgic magic. Something I could have done in my third year at the academy, if they had taught such useful applications for spells, and I had access to almost limitless energy. Concentrating very hard, I brought into being a spell component that did nothing but dig. Sort of. It was a variation of the grinding spells War Magi used to keep their mage blades razor sharp, wherein tiny swirls of magical energy abrade the steel the same way a good whetstone does, only a lot more thoroughly and completely. It was also something the Gervan had not protected against. After all, who would want to make their ugly tunnel more polished? Casting it was easy. Nothing interfered in the area under my feet. Expanding it to a massive area was harder, and harder still was linking it alchemically just to the coal. But with enough power and enough desperation, you'd be surprised what unlikely things you can accomplish. Like a rough rock across soft wood, I sent the spell past their basic subterranean defenses and started it working on the exposed face of the vein. It was completely invisible to those who weren't gifted, soundless, and should not cause any particular notice even upon close inspection. I wasn't worried about more invasive scrutiny from magical professionals either. From the locations of the sparks of their stones, all the shaman were clustered at either end of the tunnel. The busy little souls who toiled under our feet, like so many ants, were sappers and shock troops preparing for an invasion, and they had better things to do than notice a little more dust in the air than normal. Hey, it was a tunnel. Tunnels are supposed to be dirty and dusty. That's what I was counting on. I set up an independent guidance component to the spell so that it would continue without my direct supervision, and then turned my focus toward a second spell. This was something that I hadn't done since the academy, in a lab, in broad daylight, with a qualified master overseeing me. I was doing it now in the dark, surrounded by enemies, under immense pressure. My only advantage was the power I could throw at the spell. It was basic alchemy. If one takes certain rocks or natural mineral-based oils and applies various forces of nature to them, they behave in interesting ways according to their alchemical nature. Most people are almost entirely ignorant of these things, except when a craft has a need for them and learns to exploit the alchemy of nature. For example, among its other properties, coal has within its dark exterior certain gases which, when released and properly mixed with air, are flammable. Even explosive. Indeed, I was fairly certain that the Gervani air circulation spell was designed as much to keep such gases from pooling up dangerously as it was to allow the sappers to breathe fresh air. Coal normally outgasses fairly slowly. I needed to improvise something to make it do so rapidly. Applying pressure to it arcanely and increasing the surface area affected should theoretically increase the rate of outgassing. Call it inspiration, or intuition, or genius, or pure rutting luck, but I came up with a perfect spell. It was semi-autonomous, like a leak-seeking spell I used for thatched roofs, and hurried along the outgassing by very rapid vibration. It mimicked the actions of a bug, eating its way through the coal seam like a termite in moist wood, and leaving behind tiny invisible wisps of volatile gases in its wake. If I could wait long enough for the right amount of gases to build up. My spell work had taken a while, and the men in my escort were getting nervous. Goblin patrols had come within 50 feet of our party without discovering us, but they made the horses skittish. The sun was already behind the mountains and twilight was upon us. Before very long it would be dark enough for the Gervani assault to begin in earnest, and if the traffic below our feet was any indication, it would be an impressive one. But there are some things you just can't hurry. I checked on the progress of my spell, scryed the tunnel, and generally killed time. I was almost getting bored when our horses neighed, and two of the beasts went down with black-fletched arrows jutting out of them. A Gervani patrol, complete with a witchstone-wielding shaman, had eluded my please-don't-notice-us saboteurs spell and had successfully snuck up on us. If the horses hadn't caught their scent, the goblins are generally unfamiliar with horses, and horses react poorly to the dank odor of goblins, we might have been completely surprised. The attack gave me something with which to occupy my time while my spells were working. It certainly broke up the boredom. I almost smiled behind my snarl as I drew Slasher, wrapped my fist around my sphere, and guided Traveller into battle against the goblins with my knees. I could spot the entire patrol with mage sight, without using a light of any sort, and it wasn't that large. I had worked up a fair bit of anger and frustration the last couple of days, and I almost welcomed the simple clash of steel on steel as an opportunity to vent. Besides, I carried a fair bit of guilt, knowing that I had left my apprentice and the other odds and sods of Bovol Valley's magical core the fairly hopeless task of stopping a concentrated assault through the breach. By all rights, I should have been the one facing down the coming attack. Perhaps I could expunge my soul by dying valiantly in battle, I reasoned. Then, at least, the responsibility would be someone else's. Garki's, for instance. That brought a genuine smile to my lips as I charged into battle. The contest was fairly one-sided at first. Our mounted troopers were in relatively open country and able to maneuver. The score of goblin light infantry we faced was outnumbered and outpowered, and their first few ranks fell before our lances and swords before they could be reinforced. I had a grand time letting fly with bolt and flame and blast in those heated moments. I was far more used to the flow of power from the sphere now, and I felt more comfortable using it, particularly with the war magic spells I'd been using so frequently. But the Black Flag troopers were stumbling around, not always able to defend themselves in the dusky twilight against naturally darkened foes. Not everyone has the benefit of mage sight in battle. Almost as an afterthought, I hung a big flare spell over the skirmish so that the troopers could see their targets, a mage light designed to glow fiercely and then fade. It provided light for my bodyguard and temporarily blinded the patrol. But I was not the only wizard on the battlefield. The opposing shaman held back at first, too, to see where he'd be of the most use. Apparently he was taking my measure, seeing just how adept I was using the Irionite, observing what kind of mage was messing with his tunnel. I didn't even spot him among his fellows until I was about two ranks into their flank, chewing up their left side, while my men did similarly to their right. But then he revealed himself, throwing back a dark mantle he'd taken from some poor human victim and revealing his power. Suddenly I had a bad feeling about the battle, kind of like when your mother catches you playing in the mud in your festival clothes. The other shamans I had faced had been provincial rubes compared to this fellow. He was large. He stood almost 5.5 feet tall, and was visibly well-muscled, even under all of that hair. And what hair it was. Unlike his fellows, it wasn't as black as midnight. He had taken lye or some other strong chemical and bleached his pelt a ghastly shade of dirty white, much like Garki did with his beard, all except for a skull-like patch around his face, which he left black. When compared to the writhing mass of black fur that opposed us, he stood out like a beacon. Perhaps that made him more of a target, but he never seemed concerned about the possibility that he might be slain, because his coat was more reflective. Nor was he naked and unarmed, as many of the other shamans had been. He was wearing a boiled leather cuirass, dyed jet black, and heavily tooled with snaky patterns of Gavani fashion that seemed to writhe in the flare light. He held a black iron mace, all forged of one piece of metal, and around his neck was a smooth bead of Irionite, glowing eerily as he worked his spells. He wore on his head not the animal skulls of his low-rent colleagues, but a well-wrought helm of black iron, fashioned in the stylized likeness of a darkened skull. A shaman of the Black Skulls. The Gavani Elite Warrior Society driving the invasion, of whom Gurkhal spoke. This would be fun. I didn't say a word, nor uttered any war cry, as I prepared myself for the coming fight. The time for soliloquy and psyching myself up was past. By my rough calculations, I had another 4 or 5 minutes before the gas levels in the tunnel would demand for further action. I should have plenty of time to finish him off and still complete the spell, and if I didn't, that meant I was dead, and this mission would not be my concern anymore. So I bore down on the shaman with everything I had. I sent a hail of magical bolts at him from the spells on Slasher, and he shrugged them off like annoying mayflies. In return, he lashed me with a whip of blue lightning, which my own personal defenses were hard-pressed to handle. I countered with both a shower of black fire from Slasher and a bolt of searing heat from my left hand, and we were off. A straightforward magical duel is a thing of beauty for the participants, a little less aesthetic and potentially more dangerous for any bystanders. Both human cavalry trooper and goblin light infantry hurried away from the space between us, and none on either side would dare interrupt, for fear of getting caught in the magical mayhem sure to ensue. While a few continued to engage each other here and there, most contented themselves with watching the fight between magi. That left us plenty of room to try to take each other apart, while our forces fought their separate battle. This guy was good, too, compared to his fellows. He was calm and unemotional, and acted with a preternatural sense of what I was going to do next that unnerved me. He was intently focused, his black, beady little eyes staring beyond me as he cast attack after determined attack. I was hard-pressed to defend them all, and only by relying on brute force and lavish amounts of energy from my stone was I able to counter at all. Unaugmented by Arianite, I would have fallen in the first minute. I was in full battle mode, of course. My sense of time slowed to the utmost limit of my control, but there was no disguising how close to getting me he got moment to moment. When I actually had a half a second to throw an attack, it was as if he had already figured out what I was doing, and had a counterspell in the works. Frustrated, I began concentrating on avoiding his attacks rather than beating them back. That gave me a little more time to plan my own attack on the Black Skull Shaman. Imagine a 10-year-old armed with rotten eggs, or throwing them at you at once. Then imagine that you have a pot lid no bigger than your head to protect yourself. Sure, you can stop most of the eggs with your shield, but sooner or later someone will get lucky and get to go home smelling like putrid sulfur. It was like that. I found myself slipping into a deep war magic trance like I hadn't really been in since the Phyresian campaign, not really recommended while on horseback. But it was necessary, if I was going to unseat the goblin mage. I tried to look beyond his attacks, beyond his patterns of defense, and discover exactly why this furry little witch doctor was dueling like an accomplished adept. There was something off about him, I noticed, and between volleys I tried to realize what it was. Then I realized the problem. This shaman wasn't the only one riding around in his skull. He was being possessed, I guessed, by the old god, the great ghost, the dead god, that super shaman that started this whole invasion. I was up against a serious power, and I knew from that moment on that I would lose this fight. Oh, I tried even harder, but I realized that I could try as hard as I wanted and never get any closer to destroying the Black Skull Shaman than I was when I first saw him. The old god was feeding him direction and power in a way that none of my tricks could match, even with Arianite. About the only way I could possibly counter was with the help of another god, a human god, and there didn't seem to be one handy. The Black Flag Riders had been forced to retreat further back in the field as Gavanni reinforcements started to arrive. I didn't blame the men. Had I the time and the strength, I would have screamed at them to ride, ride as far and as fast as possible, fly, you fools, back to the illusory safety of Bovall Castle. But they wouldn't abandon me, curse their stupid little warriors' hearts. A few of them died as a result. As the duel got more desperate, I closed with the Black Skull until I could try to strike directly with Slasher, but he was as ready for a physical attack as a metaphysical one. The iron mace met my steel in a soul-rending crash of sound, and then we were dueling in earnest. It's hard to cast spells while you're fencing, even with a mage blade. That's why we hang them before battle, not try casting them in the middle of one. But I was inspired by desperation and the potential for failure. I kept up the power of the magical assault as much as I could while I tried to cut his heart out with my blade. He defended admirably, occasionally taking a hit, more often dishing one out. But nothing lamentably ensued. We danced to the ring of steel and iron for endless minutes. A duel was a complicated series of strikes and spells met almost perfectly by a complementary series of parries and counterspells. Even with war magic augmenting my strength and stamina, I soon tired. His mace landed, albeit glancingly, on my shins, my ribs, my shoulder, but I kept it away from my face and head and spine. I tried for every advantage, resorting to cheap cantrips to distract him when more potent spells were useless. I even tried to step on his toes. The result was inevitable. Exhausted, wounded in a dozen places, my chest beating like a bellows, I, on Traveller, looking down on the white goblin as he looked up at me thoughtfully. Had I the moisture to do so, I would have spit at him. But then that ghostly, horrific voice sounded out of the Gurvan's mouth, and that put aside my personal feelings. Traveller was already lathered. He was a Rouncy, not a warhorse. The shaman wanted to take a moment to gloat. It was hard to not let him.
"So, you are the mortal mage who impedes me," the shaman said in my own language.
His voice was the low, gravelly tone of his people, but it was augmented somehow, and in perfect Narasi. I felt it in my bones.
"Minalan, the spellmonger, at your service," I gasped, affecting the brogue of the Wilderland countryfolk.
Poorly. I don't think he got the joke.
"Spellmonger,"
the voice asked, while the black skull's lips moved and someone else's words came out. Don't ask me how I knew. I just knew it wasn't his.
"Licensed by the Censorate for General Practical Magic," I boasted. "Master Minalan of Minden's Hall. Do you need magical help? Perhaps you're lost and need help finding your way? Have a missing chicken or other livestock? A wife with a straying eye? Warts? Unsightly blemishes? Need a charm against fire, flood, or mange? Something to get that woolly white pecker up, perhaps? I'm your man. Reasonable rates. Negotiable terms. Payments in kind gladly accepted."
I don't often run my mouth in the middle of battle, but I needed a chance to catch my breath, and if this clown was stupid enough to offer me one, I was going to take it. But then the thing had the nerve to laugh at my joke. Sort of.
"You are no country mage, are you, Master Minalan? You have access to powers far beyond your colleagues, and the stink of the Alka'alon about you. A war mage, I would guess, or a court wizard on holiday."
"No, I really am a spellmonger. I can show you my credentials if you like. Still, I was enough to bury Kai Ren and his fellows handily."
"A simpleton with no real potency, save what I granted him and his brothers. Nor does your own power make you his better. Your title makes no difference. 100 human adepts would be no match for me," he boasted.
"You really don't look like much. From up here,"
I pointed out, finally catching my breath.
"No, not this shell, as you have guessed. I am still far from this sacred valley, but I am coming. Soon, if you survive this contest, then you and I shall become very well acquainted, Master Minalan. I shall delight in taking you apart like a child's toy, and putting you back together in a way more to my liking."
"Well, wait. I don't think we have been properly introduced,"
I called back weakly. I had bruises starting to blossom everywhere.
"I didn't catch your name."
"My people call me the Great Ghost," he said, that iron-headed mace slung defiantly over his shoulder. "The old god, Sherul the Deathless, among other names. That shall be sufficient for now."
"But you're not just old. You're also dead. Or didn't you realize that?"
"Yes. I know all about the cave," I said, desperately grasping at straws. "The cavern is sacred," the shaman insisted.
"I know. I understand. I know that's what you're after, and it's not grazing rights for your goat herds. Sarkusi's ancestors betrayed you and your people, and you want your holy cave back. I can even understand that. I'd be pretty pissed off, too. Look, you can have it. You can have the whole damn valley. Just let my people go forth from here in peace."
"In peace,"
said the terrible voice with a mocking laugh,
a sound so painful I would have torn off my ears if I could have moved my hands to do so. But the voice commanded your attention, if not your obedience.
I will leave you alive, Minilin, and as many of the others in that pitiful pile of rocks as can survive the assault.
That's incredibly generous of you, but
I will need you all as a sacrifice to reconsecrate our holy sites, he finished. But even that is not why I am here, Minilin. I am here for revenge. I do not care if your people stay or go. I will find them eventually. Every Humani will be found. Every last whimpering child of yours, and they shall all be sacrificed upon my altar. Their blood shall sanctify our gods, and their flesh shall feed my troops.
You're making a terrible mistake, I gasped, trying to figure out a way I could kill him without moving too much. We taste awful.
He ignored my feeble jibes. As for Kusi and his kin, I have special plans for them. They will repay us for their line's treachery, and the price will be more than they can bear.
Take him. Just let the rest of us go.
Let you go. You do not amuse me. Do not arouse my ire. My ancestors may have been foolish enough to treat with your kind, but I will show none of their weaknesses. The Sacred Valley is only the beginning, mageling. All of the lands of Kalador will one day be my dominion. You have fought well. I grant you that. You have bested several of my chosen priests. I will make your death a quick and merciful one on the sacrificial stone. After you have witnessed all the other Humani deaths, of course. Such is your reward for your temerity and your success.
Isn't that selling the cult before the mayor has been brought to stud? I said, trying to regain even a shadow of strength.
Slasher lay on the ground at my feet, and my sphere was dark in my palm, its power nearly spent from the lavish way I'd fought the duel. The power was still there, but it took a lot more time to access. Who was I kidding? I was running on sheer bluff now.
Hardly. Your folk lie at the beginning of ruin. You will soon capitulate.
Really? Because you still haven't taken the castle, after months of trying, and we only have a pitiful few Wilderlords guarding it. You have raised mighty armies, and they have broken against it like waves on the shore. And you know what has been stopping your incredible war machine?
Me. Me. A village spellmonger. A few other bumpkins, a handful of cheap mercenaries, and sheer human determination. We can drive you back. We can hold out. Help is coming.
Help? What help? Your fellow Humani have sealed the mouth of the valley against us, and cower in fear at our mention. They prepare for our onslaught, though it will do them little good. We have already outflanked their defences.
Any man is worth any three Gavani, I sneered, and a human spellmonger can trounce any Gavani shaman.
That was pure bullshit, but the longer I kept him talking, the longer I had to recover. War magic takes it out of you. So does getting beat with an iron club. The black skull showed his teeth, and it wasn't a pleasant smile.
You have seen less than a tithe of my forces, Minilin the spellmonger, and yet but little of my magic. The power stones you seek so greedily on the battlefield, the ones you pull from the corpses of the least of my followers, stones like these I have by the hundred, mere shavings and gravel doled out to my lesser minions. You crave their insignificant power and think yourself mighty. But you are a fool, chasing a fool's power. Even the charm born by this loyal girl Van is meek compared to what I have at my disposal, and that is only the beginning. You shall see, Minilin, when I arrive, should you yet breathe. At last you shall...
I never found out what he had planned for me. His gloating speech was cut off by the crackle of arcane lightning that surprised us both. A powerful magical bolt came out of nowhere and neatly severed the black skull's spine, about halfway down his back, leaving a smoking black hole in his dirty white chest. It killed him instantly, I'm certain,
but his jaw kept speaking long after his lungs could no longer fill his mouth with air. A side effect of this welcome development was the ending of the spell that had held me so securely in my saddle as I lost consciousness for a split second. I plummeted onto the rocky ground, spraining a wrist as I landed and adding abundantly to my growing collection of bruises. I considered not getting up again. After being faced with another round, with that powerful shaman and near-certain death, however, I welcomed the stimulation. It also gave me the opportunity that I was looking for to launch my attack on the tunnel. I wasted no time. I summoned every last bit of power I could muster from my depleted stone and blasted a bolt of white-hot heat straight down through the earth into the heart of the coal vein. The gases I had been releasing into the tunnel started to burn instantly, which ignited the large volume of coal dust I had created. Like a flour mill bursting with dust, the air in the tunnel was thick with gas and raw, flammable surface area. The resulting explosion stole my hearing away for a few moments and sent me sprawling to the shaking earth. I dug my face out of the dirt to greet my rescuers, sure that my apprentice had somehow managed to cut his way through the entire army of goblins to come to my aid. I was moderately surprised that it wasn't Tyndall. Instead, it was a tall, lanky man, with dark hair, a cheesy mustache, holding a staff that was taller than he was. Over his shoulder was the hilt of a mage blade that looked nearly enough like Slasher to be its twin. I had trouble placing the man's face, familiar though it was. I hadn't seen it every day for the last few months, and I had almost forgotten I'd had a life before the siege. His name was Telamon, and he was a war mage I'd fought beside and bunked with in Faris. The mustache was new. Standing behind him was Pentandra, dressed in black riding leathers and carrying a short sword and a smoking war wand. Others milled behind her in the darkness, making the black flag mercenaries a little nervous at the unexpected rescue. I didn't feel very rescued. I didn't even have the strength to summon mage sight. Penny looked concerned and kneeled by my head.
"Aren't you happy to see me, lover?"
she said in that too happy tone of voice that people use in the presence of the dying. I examined her face.
"Penny, about fucking time you showed up,"
I growled, and threw up in her lap. After that, I passed out. Again. Chapter 12. The War Magi. We were saved, only not really. Around noon the next day I stalked from one end of my tower to the other, looking alternatively at the work parties trying doggedly to fill the vacant hole under the wall in the outer bailey, and the seething mass of short, black, hairy troops just out of bowshot beyond the castle wall. I thought back on the last few days' events, and was torn between giddy excitement and hopeless despair. Funny story, that. While I was out trying to get myself gallantly killed, my little magical core, two traumatized children and a hopelessly scheming poseur, had scored surprisingly well against the foe. I think part of it was that they didn't know how difficult the task should have been. Assaulting a bridgehead is a daunting prospect for the veteran war magi. The three had come up with a simple strategy of varying the types of spells they threw at the invading force within their limited capacity, and likewise limited how much force they put behind each new casting. Never throw the same spell twice, was the idea, and don't focus over much on power as much as speed. With that kind of nuisance harassment, the Gavani shamans had to summon a different defense each volley, which is time-consuming and drains power. It kept them busy and didn't leave them much time to support their troops effectively with scouting and scrying. When their infantry advanced too carelessly into the area between their field fortifications and ours, hilarity ensued. When the vanguard of their troops had crossed into that area, Tyndall threw an activation spell that detonated his war wand, placed there for that purpose. Not the one I bought for him. Remember the first war wand he built? That rough-hewn, overstuffed twig I cautioned him about? All those spells, packed as tight as a cork in a bottle, were bound up into that little unstable piece of wood. Well, my smart-ass apprentice decided to experiment with dangerous mystical forces while my back was turned. He continued to power the thing, enchanting it as frequently as he increased the bindings to the straining point.
and then cast an almost elegant meta-spell to allow the wand to discharge all at once, in a loud, devastating discharge. The shaman's defensive spells, toned down to deal with the various low-power bolts harassing them, were neither prepared nor positioned properly to avoid the blast. Over 100 Gavanni were slain in the Outer Bailey at one instant, and thrice that many were wounded. At least one of the shamans was standing in close proximity to the blast and was killed. While the defenses built up around his witch stone absorbed a portion of the force, it wasn't enough to save him, though thankfully his Irionite was not destroyed. The whole thing was as dangerous and stupid a stunt as you could ask for, and would have made Tyndall subject to military justice in a real army. But it did have the twin saving graces of both working as planned and saving the day. Immediately after the blast, while the smoke and dust were still billowing, the castle's archers discharged a volley just over the rough stone redoubt that encircled the breach, at near point-blank range. My irregular magical core increased the ferocity of their attacks, augmenting it with blinding and deafening effects in the air over the confused and demoralized goblins, while the mercenary pikemen pushed forward all around the circle, interspersed with shield men braced on the redoubt. The Crinrock were chanting a hauntingly discordant hymn, or dirge, or jolly drinking song in their native tongue, and waiting for anything uglier than they were to get through the pipes. The sudden, ferocious attack was enough to begin a general retreat around the mouth of the tunnel. The congestion between incoming and outgoing troops was chaotic. The Gavanni captains were still trying to regroup and counterattack when my bit of tunnel alchemy overtook them. The explosion was so powerful that a dozen Gavanni had been blown clear into the surprised ranks of the Crinrock, far behind our makeshift wall. They welcomed the practice. They were starting to get bored. While some of the surviving Gavanni still fought hard and furiously, our people were able to mop up much of the rest of the force before my battered body was returned to the castle by my rescuers. No quarter. But then the castle rejoiced, Tyndall told me, when they saw the triumphant return of the spellmonger at the head of a column of reinforcements. They even chanted, "Spellmonger!" as we rode in, and there was no doubt who they were talking about. Despite Garki's presence and demonstrated magical competence in the defense of the castle, when someone in the bailey said, "the spellmonger," they meant me. That proved to be a metaphorical burr under his saddle. Penny and Telemann weren't alone. Plucky little Penny had brought 19 itinerant war magi, mostly young veterans of the Phoenician campaign, looking for trouble and hungry for a chance at a witchstone. Among them were some old friends, some acquaintances of note, and a few strangers. They all wanted Irionite, and were willing to do just about anything to get it. They had heard Penny's message, and word had spread among my former colleagues like a flux on a ship. Before she left Rhemir, she had 6 eager hotshots ready to ride to the ends of Calador, and they weren't far wrong, if it meant Irionite. Her cousin, Planos, nice fellow, I'd met him, was green with envy that he could not accompany them. The rest were recruited along the way. Her father, Osirio, had insisted on sending 100 mounted household troops as a personal guard, presumably to protect his little darling's non-existent virtue, led by a grizzled old one-eyed Rhemirian mercenary captain, veteran of 100 campaigns. Pentandra had started out with another 300 mercenary mounted archers from Farinal, but they were commandeered by the Lord of Gans, and not allowed to pass beyond the River Tar. There was an invasion of the Wilderlands going on, he explained. He would have taken her company of guards, too, had they not threatened to attack. Penny brought the disappointing news that while no one else was riding to our rescue, the menace in the west had not gone unnoticed at the ducal level. Goblins ranged in war bands all across the Alshari Wilderlands, as far east as Tudri. The ducal warlord was finally taking an interest in the threat of invasion. Nice to know we weren't completely forgotten. They shot their way through Moor Pass, noting that Moor Tower was now in possession of the Gavanni, though many less Gavanni than had previously occupied it, after the war magi forced their way through the pass. From the moment they entered the valley, they had been fighting one long-running skirmish. Gavanni were everywhere. Only by stealth, superior skill, and timely illusion did they push on through. Penny's band had stopped first at the Brandmount Fortress, and rescued the last 900 survivors, 300 of whom were in fighting shape. A small guard was detailed to escort the wounded and civilians to Moor Pass, while the rest of the troops pushed on to Beauvall Castle. It was uncertain whether or not they would be able to force their way through, but they had no desire to remain, and chose the chance at death on the road to death in the castle. Hard to blame them. The smaller keep did not fare as well as we had, even though the force that faced them was a tenth the size of the army that besieged Beauvall Castle. Brandmount's walls had been breached repeatedly by siege engines flinging stones, and mobbed with wild Gervani troops. At first they were able to drive the invaders back at great cost, until they couldn't maintain the outer defences, and were forced to retreat further into the keep. Had Penny and her expedition not shown up when they had, the defenders could not have held out, for all their tenacity, for more than another week. Cousy's brother had made it, though he was now missing his left hand and burdened with a nasty infection, or poison, or both. Zagor and a surviving fragment of the Gobarba order, still singing hymns in devotion to a long-dead god, had survived. The Boliek sisters had not been so lucky. As hedge witches, it turned out that they were far better at curing gout than clobbering goblins. They weren't alone on the casualty list. The siege of Brandmount had been deadly, and the evacuation had been costly. Considering the odds they were facing, it was no minor miracle that anyone escaped at all. I have to hand it to Penny. For someone who wasn't a war mage, who had, literally, never been in any sort of fight in her life, she had plunged into the heat of battle with a cool head and a good eye for carnage. Tarleman told me later that she acted as if she had been disposing of troops and building strategies all of her life. She was no slouch, tactically, either. In a daring raid on the Gavani command post overseeing Brandmount siege, Penny had captured a shaman's witchstone, and with its power and some skillful tactics, she led her people in through the lightly manned siege lines to liberate the fortress. After that, things get fuzzy, but there were some powerful illusions involved, some quick and efficient strikes by her guards, plus a commando raid by the 6 war magi who specialized in that sort of thing, on top of some inspired mayhem from Zagor, who showed what a lifetime of attunement to a witchstone could do for a mage. The result of the daring plan was the destruction of the command structure of the besiegers, the glorious sight of their own infantry attacking and slaughtering their own artillery, and 3 more witchstones captured. All the while, Penny led the column of survivors out through the lines. I almost wish I had been there. Zagor had put the Gavani into a situation where they could either quell a magically induced rebellion from their fiercest fighters, or go after the fleeing humans. The confusion allowed Penny to lead them on a mad dash through more hostile territory to Beauvall Castle, only to save me and the besieged at the nick of time. What a girl. The castle was a little more crowded now, but the breath of fresh hope everyone felt, not to mention the close brush with total destruction, gave us a good reason to be accommodating to the new arrivals. They wasted no time and pitched in with the defense right away. Within a day, the repair work on the failed breach was underway, and the sentries on the walls were doubled, with one of Penny's fresh veteran guards shadowing every 2 militiamen or mercenaries. Those Remeran soldiers were for more than show. The luxury-loving Imperial-descended Remerans have an undeserved reputation for being effete cowards, but when it came to the fighting men from Pentandra's family estates, they were every bit as tough and adept at their art as the Wilderlords. Those dusky, war-eyed bastards were as tough as anyone I'd fought with in Faris. Not that the goblins cared. The goblin army was keeping its distance after their defeat at the breach, no doubt regrouping and preparing for yet another assault. Their numbers had not visibly suffered from either Penny's strike or my pyrotechnics. Indeed, more troops were arriving every day. I didn't much care. Being outnumbered 50-1 or 500-1 didn't really matter anymore. I was just happy to see a few more warm bodies manning the battlements, and they were happy to see some sturdier battlements to man. But otherwise their arrival proved a bittersweet reunion. Many of the Bovali of the Northern Valley had not survived, and those who had made it had lost family and friends in the siege. Cousy and his brother were visibly moved to see each other again, though his brother was on a stretcher, too sick from his wounds to mount a horse. Peasant militiamen searched for news of relatives, and were often told the worst. There was much weeping in both joy and sadness. The tower opposite mine was vacated and devoted to housing many of the new war magi, led by Penny, while space was made in the inner bailey for Penny's guard, and in the outer bailey for the surviving commoners from Brandmount Keep. Snug quarters, but it beat the alternative. So it would seem as if we were rescued, this being the first sign of outside help. But not really. Penny filled me in on the military situation in the rest of the duchy, while I recovered from my exertions. We weren't the only ones getting clobbered, apparently. Comparatively large bands of Gavani had burst out past Moor Tower, and invaded Gans, Pressan, and beyond. Even Tudri were starting to get raids on the outlands of the city, she reported. There were all the signs of a major invasion, and everyone was taking the idea seriously now. She also told me that His Grace, Duke Lenghin of Alsha, had been informed, and was feeling far more anxious about the other goblin incursions into his profitable lands north and south of Beauval than our desperate plight. That was timber and iron country, after all, the basis for Alshar's mighty fleet. Nor was he sitting on his hands. The Duke had put out the call to his vassals to assemble his troops, a long, complicated and politically delicate process in a feudal government, and in the meantime, he was hiring mercenaries and impressing peasants to fill in gaps. But things just weren't moving fast enough, and before any army of note could be brought to bear on the problem, the goblins were taking advantage of the feeble defences of the Wilderlands. The western barony of Dunal and the entire northern county of Lokar were both now battlefields, though the invaders had nowhere near the numbers that were rapidly filling up Beauval. The entire duchy was arming, supposedly, but His Grace had already written us off as lost. What was one little Wilderland's domain compared to the rest of his realm? The navy needed timber and iron, not cheese. If it hadn't been for Penny's noble bearing and absolute insistence, and her escort of powerful war magi, she never would have been allowed beyond Tudri, much less gained entrance past the towers at the pass. So we could expect no further help. The news had come as a crushing blow to some in the castle, but for others, myself included, it was actually a relief to hear. The failed breach in the wall was just the most recent reminder that our siege was becoming more and more a losing proposition. If there was no relief in sight, and with battle elsewhere now, how could we hope to survive? There was no way that I could see, not with a bucket full of Irionite and a squad of adepts. Beauval Vale was lost. But how do you explain that to the Lord of the Domain? Sire Kusi was strutting around the halls and baileys of the castle like a proud little cockerel, as if he had pulled the Ramirans out of his own purse and rescued his northern keep by himself. Not even the battered image of his younger brother on a stretcher, arm in sling, racked with fever, seemed to have much of an effect on his outlook. To hear Kusi tell it, the Govani had gotten licked so badly that they were packing up and going home, right after they all lined up and swore eternal peace to the people of Beauval Vale. While hope was a much-needed commodity around the castle, what he was doing went beyond good leadership. It was a blatant disregard of the reality. There are limits to faith, and he shamelessly crossed them and never looked over his shoulder. Now, I admit, I was still irate over his very public blame of me for the breach, and after hearing how his ancestors conquered the province, I was even less inclined to be deferent to him. But by claiming that salvation was at hand, when it was clearly not, was almost criminal. It was certainly irrational. Even Sir Kay, his trusted castellan, looked concerned, though he refused to speak an ill word against his liege. Sir Roncil had no such qualms. He quietly came to me with a pair of his chivalrous brethren and asked about my plans for escaping the situation. But Kusi, he thought the day all but won. Perhaps it was my commoner's upbringing, but while I had always been taught to be respectful and slightly in awe of the nobility, I was coming to realize that the relationship worked in both directions. When a leader you are sworn to respect and obey comes out and simply lies about things you know are untrue, and does it to your face, it is a fundamental betrayal of trust that destroys the peasant-warrior relationship. Huin the Tiller and Duin the Destroyer are brothers in the pantheon, Duin is only elevated as a god of the nobility, because he supposedly destroys only to protect or conquer. He does not seek to mislead his own people. Similarly, when the folk of the Riverlands are faced with a dishonest, corrupt, or even openly arrogant lord, there is a long tradition of the peasantry rising in arms. That happens much less often in the Wilderlands, due to the different social structure. Villeins and serfs are rare. Most of the Wilderland peasants are freemen, and the sparser population. To my knowledge, Beauval Vale had never enjoyed a peasant uprising before, but every time Cusi crowed about our impending victory, in defiance of the observable truth, I was becoming more tempted to lead one. I had more important duties that morning. After resting and healing for a dozen all-too-brief hours, I had the responsibility for distributing the captured Irionite to the war magi who had risked life and limb to get it. More importantly, I had to instruct them on their use. I'd begun to notice a strange feeling that had developed when using my sphere, a feeling as if reality itself was a little warped around me. Of course, I worried about Gavanni magic and the influence of the Great Ghost, or whatever he liked to be called. I had already taken the precaution of associating the two pieces of Irionite that Penny's troops had captured with my sphere, to shield it from Gavanni influences. But I was starting to think that the effect was a product of just using the stone itself. I consulted with Zagor about this, when he felt